So I've been asked to give a talk, and I actually had to agree because no one else wanted to be the meat in the lion's head. But what I'll try to do is basically review some of the things that we worry about when we try to do numerical simulations and what numerical relativity is trying to do. So if you wonder why we have the title of our workshop, The Interaction of Compact Objects, well, it's basically our main goal is to describe the dynamics of some systems that have sources that are very compact. And I'm going to go on saying why is it that we're interested in those. It serves two purposes. One is a very practical one, and I'm just going to refer on that in a second. But the other purpose is to bring a new tool in the description or to try to analyze Einstein's equations to try to obtain more information out of them. As you'll see later in my talk, the equations are quite complicated, and this has prevented basically for about 90 years to extract much of the physics. So we know quite a bit of GR, but that has obtained out of tremendous effort of a number of scientists, but also after doing considerable simplifications on the theory, which limits the range of things that have been considered in the past. But now, the possibility of actually detecting gravitational waves with these new generations of gravitational detectors have spurred quite a bit of extra energy in the field. And we're all here trying to fight with the problems we have in actually trying to get solutions, particular solutions for Einstein's equations. So that, among other things, has brought relativists from the small realm of an office wondering what if to a place like Santa Barbara, trying to get together and see if we can solve some of the problems we have. So from that point of view, it's quite an improvement, especially if you're someone that comes from Baton Rouge. So why I say that GR is getting itself into a practical realm? Well, basically, when I got into GR because I think it's one of the coolest theories there is, and I actually think I can prove it rigorously. So if we talk about interactions,
California.
Now if we think about basic interactions, so we have the strong, the electromagnetic, the weak, and gravity. And if we order these by their strength, so basically we have this being, let's say, if I choose a 10, this is like 10 to the minus 2. That's 10 to the minus, never remember this number, 12, 13. And this is like 10 to the minus 40. So in energetic terms, GR is the coolest theory there is. There is also the interaction, or the range of interaction. This is short, this long, and this long care, because gravity, you cannot you cannot counteract. There is no negative mass, so if you're thinking at long distances, gravity is always going to win. So for practical purposes around, say, the Earth, Newtonian theory has done pretty good for us, and it's the use of GR in practical purposes has been quite limited. But perhaps one of the nicest applications of it is actually GR is GPS. Here in practical, I'm thinking of an accountant looking at the field and seeing where it's practical or not. So the GPS is something that you can buy for about 10 to the 10 US bucks, and it lets you know where you are. But it only uses GR in a very weak way, because the compaction ratio of the Earth, which is this thing we call, which is this ratio, if this is the radius of the Earth, this is about 10 to the minus 7. But now there is this detectors, gravitational wave detectors, and the US one is LIGO, which you can buy for about 10 to the 8 US bucks. And so, and here, GMC squared over the radius of, say, a black hole, and we'll talk about that in a second, is about 10 to the minus 1. So this accountant immediately would conclude that GR is linear, but as you'll see later, GR is nonlinear. So the main goal of these detectors is actually to detect gravitational waves, which have so far not been detected directly. Indirectly, we have pretty good indications and actually have a Nobel Prize to the field because of the prediction of an orbit of, say, a binary pulsar and the signals we would detect from them. There is variation due to the energy that is being carried out by the waves, which makes the orbit shrink very slowly. But with LIGO, we'll detect it. We'll detect waves directly. And not only that, we want to, this O in LIGO stands for observatory, we want to use these waves to understand the universe. And it's important, this distinction, I mean, gravitational waves differ from electromagnetic waves in a bunch of fundamental ways. The first one is gravitational waves as opposed to electromagnetic waves are not shielded. And as they propagate, they interact very poorly with the surrounding matter. So we would get a very fair description, a very fair information of the source that emitted them. We can get electromagnetic waves only after decoupling, so we can only go so far to the past, while with gravitational waves we can go pretty much to almost the Big Bang. And instead of displacements, which is the effects of electromagnetic waves, gravitational waves cause shear. So basically they shrink one direction, they expand the other one, and they do the other way around. So if you see what the LIGO detector looks like, it's basically an L with the same length in each side, so that if a wave passes by, it's going to shrink one direction, elongate the other one, and by measuring the phase shift of some particular signal that is sent on this along both arms, we can detect with measure a wave. So let me just think about what is it that these detectors will see, and why is it so difficult, or why is it that we have to pay 10 to the 8 US dollars to come up with a detector? So you can actually produce an estimate of the gravitational wave strength by using what is known as the quadrupole formula. So that says that the strength of the wave goes like G Q double dot C squared over R, where this Q is the quadrupole moment of the source, and this R is the distance from the source to us. And here there is also a very important difference between electromagnetic waves and gravitational waves as far as detection is concerned, which is that we'll be actually looking at the strength of the wave that goes as 1 over R as we go out in distances. Well, usually when we measure things in the electromagnetic spectrum, they go as 1 over R squared. So we're gaining also a lot as far as reaching out in distance is concerned. But now, if we want to, so again, this is the quadrupole of the source. So in order to make the strongest possible wave, we want this to be maximized. So if for a source of mass m, Q would go as m over some distance squared. And roughly, Q double dot goes m v squared. So if now replace this in here, G m v squared c squared over R, and this is like the kinetic part of the energy. If I plug the c squared in here, then I have something. Sorry, this goes, I think, c fourth. Yeah. So this is C4. So this is like a mass. So this is this part here, which is like a mass. So this looks like the potential field of the source where at the point where the detector is. And so we would like to maximize this. So in order to maximize this, we need very compact sources and hopefully very close ones. And so on the objects that we know maximize the potential energy are, say, neutron stars, where the potential or the compaction ratio is roughly 0.1, or black holes, where this is basically 0.5. So we would like to, for having these, in order to have the maximum possible strength, we would like to have, again, very compact sources and as close as they could be. But let's suppose now we evaluate this at, say, 200 megaparsecs. So as to cover a very large region where systems would contain these kind of sources that vary quite fast, so that we have a good contribution from the time derivative of the quadrupole moment would be at the observer. So 200 megaparsecs, if you plug in the numbers and you assume that the mass of the source is roughly a solar mass, then H goes like 10 to the minus 21. So the strength is actually quite weak from us. And if you're wondering what 200 megaparsecs is, because I actually had to wonder myself, I never had these numbers in mind. So 200 megaparsecs is about 10^3 to the 6 light years. Still, if light year, it doesn't really ring a bell too much. And you can transform that to 10^12 kilometers. And again, if that doesn't sound too familiar, you can translate this to 6^10^22 football fields, which seems to be the standard unit of measures in the States. And here, because the numbers are so big, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about real football or American football.
Is each of those 100 yards from
home?
Is each of those 100 yards from
home? Well, the American football field is about 91 yards, if you don't count the end zones.
Meters.
And 100 meters, the soccer field is about 100 meters.
Yeah, but if you use the natural unit of yard, the
American. But yard is not a natural unit.
Hey, I once saw an article in Nature which calculated
all the fundamental constants in British imperial units and showed that it came out closer to integers. I also saw an article in Nature of some people that are trying to see if a referee missing a call, an offside call in soccer, could be due to the bending of light. But I don't know if that tells you more about nature than anything else. But a lot more fun than watching baseball. You'll see, you're going to be in the team, eh? So what we're saying is we have a pretty weak signal strength. We want to know where we actually have those kind of sources in our, so that our detectors will see.
This is a small dimensionless number, but it's not clear what it.
That's going to be more or less what the shift, or
it's delta L over L.
It's delta L over L, right? So if this small shrinkage, if you want, over the whole length, it's going to be of this size. So it's actually pretty darn small. But you also would like to see where there is a number of sources, there is enough number of sources for the government to actually invest money in this. So, and these numbers are very hand-wavy in a way. I mean, Lars is able to say more about that. But if you use binary pulsars, I mean, the known binary pulsars, searchers, or the or models of population synthesis, you can come out with some rough estimates of how many, say, neutron stars collisions are going to be out there. And this depends on how far you're looking. For instance, to 20 megaparsecs, we expect mergers of these guys from, say, 1 over 3,000 years. So about 1 every 3 years. So a 10^3 difference is pretty large. If you're looking at 300 megaparsecs, this goes from 1 a year to about 2 per day. for black hole mergers have similar numbers. One per year, and say 10 to the 3 megaparsecs is 2 per month to 10 per day. So, and I'm giving you these numbers because the first line in numbers are the numbers that people in LIGO have. So LIGO will have basically two installments to it. One is the basic LIGO, the LIGO that is currently being operated. Data is being taken on LIGO 1, but they are still not to yet have not yet reached maximum sensitivity, but they are getting close to this ballpark. Then there is going to be a subsequent revision of LIGO. There is going to be more technology built in it, and now these are more or less the target goals. So the idea is that LIGO 1 might not see anything, but LIGO 2 will have a pretty good chance of detecting either mergers, black holes, or neutron stars, and other sources. But then, now the problem is that one. The signal is still very weak. We have to be able to use these detectors and dig up the signal. The noise is quite bad for a number of reasons. The signals in the noise in the detectors, noise where the detectors is sitting, etc. And so the theoretical side needs to provide information that these guys can use in data analysis to dig out the data. And let me just give you an example, something you can go to the web and actually get these things out. This is a mock-up simulation. No, it's not. This is going to be sound. Of a binary system consisting of black holes, and it's going to be in the early stages. And I'm going to say more about this in a minute. These guys are orbiting around each other and slowly getting towards a point near the plunge. So this is how the signal would look like. So the frequency, it sweeps up in frequency, and that's basically what it is. Hey? No, that the next one is going to sound better. Yeah. Now you put that signal and assume it's at 600 kiloparsecs and add on top of that the simulated noise that the detector will have, this is what you'll hear. And if you were lucky, there was a signal. At some point, it's whoop. But if you put a 15 megaparsec, so you basically hear nothing. The signal is still there, but somehow you have to dig it up. And it's up to, let me play the first one again. Maybe I can. But ultimately, independent on, and the LIGO people might not be too happy for me saying this, ultimately what we would like to know is the answer for the two-body problem in GR. And it's been about 60 years since Einstein, Infernal Hoffman tried to give it a crank to the problem, and we still don't have the answer. An answer that in the Newtonian case is very simple to do, you just get in a few lines. So we don't have the full dynamics of a two-body problem in GR, and that's something we would like to have the solution. So let me now go to the particular binary problem, to a binary problem, and try to tell you what is it that we are trying to do. So basically, we envision the problem having, say, two compact objects. The details of the object doesn't matter too much, and in fact, for black holes, we don't even care about anything because, well, they're. I'll say something more about that in a second. So we assume we have two compact objects that are in orbit around each other. Because gravitational waves are carrying energy away, which comes from the quadrupole, it's actually these gravitational waves will tend to circularize the orbit. So these orbits are more or less circular. And at early stages, these guys are more or less quasi-adiabatically spiraling around each other. Then there is an intermediate stage. So this stage is called the in spiral. There's an intermediate stage where these guys basically plunge against each other, and the details of that we don't really know. And this is where we're spending all of our time nowadays. And then at the later time, we basically have a single black hole or a single object that either collapses to form a black hole or sheds some of its structure to end up with a single black hole sitting quiet there. So this is end stage is called the ring down stage. This is the merger stage. So here, the velocities associated are quite small, are much smaller than the velocity of light. And the standard way of treating that part and what was used to create those sound waves is to use positronic approximation. So you basically assume you use a Taylor expansion on V over C, and you just stick to the first few orders. At the late stages, you're assuming you have a single black hole that is somewhat distorted, so you just basically solve perturbations. Of single black hole. So this is an approximation, and so is this one. But in the intermediate stage, that's where these two things are basically hitting each other. There's nothing we can assume is small. The velocities are going to be pretty high. The field of each one is already pretty high, and you cannot consider the system as a single one that is being perturbed. So here you have to solve the equations in full. Which means we have to solve Einstein's equations, which in its simplest form is just GAB equal A pi TAB. And if you're dealing with just black holes are solutions of the vacuum equations, which means this guy is set to zero. And so the simplest possible scenario is actually having two black holes colliding. And that's why I call spherical chaos. I mean, the simplest way you can pose a two-body problem is just solve Einstein's equations in vacuum with a source given by two black holes. So now that we set the stage for solving Einstein's equations, we have to actually do it. The problem is, well, Einstein's equations are pretty nasty. This thing that we call that is called the Einstein tensor, GAB equals zero, is actually a set of 10 equations that are, let me get a bit fancier here, that are quasi-linear. That doesn't mean it's linear. I mean, you cannot, two solutions of these added up do not give you a third solution. But it's quasi-linear, which means that if you write an equation, say, for the scalar field, for a field, like dA phi, equals zero. You could write the equations this way. So just derivatives of the field heated by something that would not have derivatives of the field. It can have the field, but not derivatives of the field. That simplifies a lot because now this does feed in a lot of rigorous theorems in mathematics. For the fully nonlinear case, and it's actually quite problematic, and the mathematical knowledge is much more limited. The second is, you could write equations in such a way that they are linearly degenerate, which basically means no shocks, which is actually pretty good. So it means that if you have a discontinuity in the sources, and so in this case I'm setting equal to zero, but if we have a discontinuity in the sources, the field doesn't have to be discontinuous. In fact, what this says is if you're going to have a problem, it's going to be a problem everywhere. It's going to lead to singularities instead of shocks. So if you have shocks, you have discontinuities in the derivatives, but not discontinuities in the field. But the field is continuous. Here, everything will go to hell. So we have to deal with this. And this is one of the problems that we face. Another problem is that Well, the equations are covariant. We are free to choose coordinates in any way we want. And in particular, we can choose four coordinates such that here what we are solving for is we're solving for the metric tensor, which we use to measure distances. And these, again, are 10 components. We can use four of these to knock four of those down. So we can just solve for six components. So now we are a system that is a priori overdetermined. We have six things to solve for, and we actually have 10 equations. We're already starting to hit some of the problems that we have to face in solving these equations numerically. So still, this is not quite good to put in a computer. Computers are good to, given some initial state of the system, if you have the right equations, predict the solution at the future time. But so far, in this GAB equals zero, we have no mentions of time. We know the time and space in general relativity do not have a clear separation. In fact, there is no separation. So somehow we have to come out to break these equations. Einstein worked pretty hard to work it, to end up writing it this way. We're going to undo what he did. And somehow we're going to introduce a time coordinate. And that is going to let us write an initial value problem of the equations. So there is a way, and I'm not going to bore you with the details, to having chosen these four coordinates appropriately, you can come up with two set of equations. So one set that is called the evolution equations, which actually give you basically Gij equals something, which is quite messy. And then another set, which are called constraint equations, these are six, which are at most have just first time derivative of the metric. So Gij in this picture is the metric that a t equal constant surface, which is now the three-dimensional surface, has. So if you want to measure distances along points that live on that hypersurface, you can obtain it with Gij. So something that we can prove is that if, again, we have this problem of the overdeterminacy. Something that we can prove is that if you give data here to satisfy the constraint equations, let me just call it. Then they are going to be satisfied at a later time if you now evolve the equations using these upper ones. But that there is not trivial if you have boundaries. If you have boundaries, now you're solving the equation. This is true only in the domain of dependence, but if you of that point, but if you're thinking about a solution here, then the domain of dependence here actually hits the boundaries, and so you have to be careful in not only the initial data that you give, but also on the boundary data that you give so as to deal with the system in a consistent way. So that's another sore point that we're working hard with, because for years we knew about the stability or well-posedness results for the boundary-free case. In fact, it's been like 50 years since we know about that. But only about 2 years ago, the first paper appeared that actually proved that you can write equations in a well-posed way that does involve the boundaries. But I'm not going to get into that.
In other words, it specifies the appropriate boundary conditions that preserve
boundaries. Right. And it's not a trivial thing.
Are the boundary conditions are preserved ahead of time, or they depend on
that? Actually, they depend. So what you end up having is a system. So there is some information that you can give freely from this side that at far distances do relate to incoming radiation. And then there is a system of equations that you have to propagate up. So you're given data, appropriate data here, and appropriate data here, and data at the intersection, you have to iterate that. So you have a system of equations that live on your domain, and a system of equations that live on your boundaries.
Can you solve it before you start the evolution?
In some cases, you may. but in general, it actually couples because it has some information on this guy trying to hit it. And then you have backscattering, and somehow you have to count on that. If you now take an
approach. You don't know the boundary conditions before you solve
it. No.
What do you mean by a well posed?
You actually, in the estimate of the behavior of the solution, you end up having to bound not only the initial data, but also an integral along this, which has to be bounded in order for the whole bound to work. But before we get into this, let me now discuss where you can actually do it. So suppose you want to solve Einstein's equations in 3D. What are going to be the computational costs associated with doing that? So the first thing is the memory. Never remember if it has 1M or 2M. Let me just put it 2 just in case. So the sources that we have, black holes, have roughly size M. And so in order to have a fair representation of the region around the sources, and I'm going to be thinking that you do the simplest thing here, that you're going to have your continuous space, and you're going to just put a sequence of points along. So this is the finite difference approximation. So you want this distance between points to be roughly, at least, delta x over m over 10. So 10 points around the scale of the source. You also have another thing, which is where you want to put the boundaries. And the boundaries, you likely or you hopefully would like to put them as far as you can, because it's a complicated problem. And actually, the problem itself doesn't have boundaries, so the boundaries are artificial. And it's not clearly, even if you can prove well posing of the problem, it's not clear what the right boundary conditions are that conform to the physical situation in mind. So let me just tentatively put 500m. So now if you combine these two, that means you have 10 to the 4 points in each direction of your simulation. But now this is 3D, so you have to the cube, so you have 10 to the 12 points. You roughly have about 10 to the 2 variables because of everything that you have to do to compute the right-hand size, et cetera. And each variable at the point will require 8 bytes. So this is roughly 10 to the 15 bytes, so which is 10 to the 3 terabytes. Now let me think about the computational cost, which basically is how much time you have to wait till you actually get one of the simulations done. So per point, in order to evaluate the right-hand size, et cetera, you roughly have 10 to the 3 floating point operations, either addition, divisions, et cetera. The number of steps, well, that means that that means the following. 10 to the 3 times 12, which are the number of points, you have 10 to the 15 floating point operations per step. But now you want to do this, you want to evolve in time. And roughly, you'll also, for the scale and for the length of time, you'll expect these things. So you want to start early on in the simulation that you can match to the spiral and evolve it for a while to actually the heat and form a single one. So you roughly would like to evolve for about 500m, which means your delta T, and also the delta T, the amount of time you can go up in time, is roughly, actually it's worse than this, but let me assume it's like goes like delta X. That means that in order to do this, you need to do a number of time step about 10 to the 4. So now you combine these two numbers, and so you have 10 to the 19 floating points total. And if you are lucky enough that you deal with a 1 teraflop machine, that means that you have to wait 10 to the 7 seconds, which is roughly 100 days. So this is per simulation, assuming everything went well. I wrote a paper 2 years ago when I estimated this, and I actually was quite hopeful back then, and these numbers came out several orders of magnitude worse, so we are much more in the red. But if I'm wearing this in Bush administration, maybe that would be a good thing. But I'm not, so I'm worried over this. But then again, this is assume, I here assume that I was using a single grid, a unigrid, and I wasn't doing anything fancy as far as numerical techniques are concerned. So there are a number of things that one could do to improve the situation. One is this thing called AMR, which stands for Adaptive Mesh Refinement. Which basically puts points where you need and takes points away when you don't. This will help a lot. And there are also other types of approximation, like spectral methods, final elements, that could help. But still, it's going to be a pretty costly simulation, no matter what you do. So after setting the hopeful stage that basically we don't even have enough computer and we don't even have enough memory or enough time to wait for the answer, let's go on. Because LIGO is going on, no matter what our problems are.
But is it the case that you could even do the calculation if you had those things?
There are. I think I dig myself a hole here. There are several. And I'm going to use you. You wrote a paper in 1982 entitled "The 3 Minutes of the Last 3 Minutes of the Merger." There, you argue that at early stages, one could, if you're lucky with LIGO, could extract from the data analysis the masses and the spins. So now if you give me that, if I'm allowed to work under that assumption that I'm going to get the masses and spins from the early stage, now I can run that. That I think is doable. What I see very hard is that the field will provide the templates in a relatively short time.
But I'm asking more that there's the way you're presenting it is that there's no mathematical or computational subtlety. It's really just a question of brute force. Is that really true?
No. Well, you can always say, well, if using brute force didn't work, it's because you didn't use enough of it. But no, there is the boundary issue, for instance. You could always say, I'm going to push the boundary even a lot further out. And if I do whatever I do there that is wrong, but it's still stable, I'll be able to evolve for enough time to get there. So that will be just a brute force, and the brute force will take care of that. But we'd like to do a lot better.
Yeah, I understand.
When you have two bodies, you don't have axial symmetry.
No. In a generic, because you have also the spins, and so there's no way to get out of it. Maybe if you do some simulations, there is some. Now there is the other thing to what you do. If you run several simulations and you end up getting or seeing that there is some robust feature of the wave that comes out, that already would be good information for the data analysis side. I mean, the issue here is that they don't have anything good, and basically whatever you can give them is going to be of help. Of course, assuming what you give them is actually good, but. So, what time? Okay.
But if you assume surface symmetry, what's the case?
Then there is no waves. So that's the other problem.
If you assume
axial symmetry, then you can do some simulations. There, you can get waveform out of it. Matt and Franz Pretorius, Steve Liebling, and Eric Hirschman are actually working on that. And so hopefully there will be robust features in the waveforms that you can use. Then there are other approaches that basically.
How much does that cut it down?
Oh, by a lot. I mean, just instead of whatever number I had before, like 10 to the 4, now instead of 3, you have a 2. So now it's you knock down just 3 orders of magnitude because of that in both numbers.
the realistic sources will not actually submit.
Well, how do you know this bit?
Just two bodies is an axis symmetric. A ring would be an axis symmetric.
Sorry?
A ring.
Well, it could be a head-on collision with the spins aligning just. So nature would have to be very helpful.
Repeat my statement, the realistic sources.
So anyway, let me now mention a few things of what activities we're doing here and why is it that we're worried about. So one of the things, I wrote the evolution equations, and I said it was something like Gij, TT equals something. But you also have the constraint equations that basically didn't have time derivatives, first, second time derivatives, Gij equals something else. Now you can think of this as a constraint. So you just basically pass everything to the other side and this is equal to zero. If you add that in here with an arbitrary parameter, arbitrary factor, you don't change the structure of the equation. You still have a wave-like equation. This will not change, if you do it correctly, the properties of the equation, but actually numerically it can completely can make a huge difference. Let me just give you an example. Say if you write Maxwell's equation, so you have E dot curl B, say of course B dot curl E, and now you also have say in vacuum dV equals zero, and the same thing with E. So you have options here. One is you could add any of these in here with an appropriate factor, actually with an appropriate vector, and just evolve that. Amazingly, that does change how this numerical solution behaves. You could also say, I'm going to drop one of these equations, one of these components, and I'm going to solve it from here. So that's what is called a constrained evolution, where you use these equations at every single step to get rid of one of the variables, or solve for one of the variables. Both options are being looked at, and they're being used at different applications, and actually they do play a major role. Like in Mark Scheele and the group at Cornell did a simulation where they basically have a single black hole. They only did this, and evolving the single black hole with one system would basically just crash right away. Where this, if you put time here, this were 50 m or so, hopefully. And then if you just add and play a little bit with the parameters, then you have something like that. Where here was like 1,000 m. So it seems that just the structure of the equations, when translated to the numerical arena, where you are not solving exactly these equations, you're solving a discrete analog that admits more solutions, then you can excite this extra solution that actually goes to hell. In the limit, they are not there, in the limit of infinite resolution. But at a given resolution, you have these things. So there is a lot of activity in trying to come up with better behaved equations, if you can call it them like that. Let me now mention a different thing, a different topic, which is, I said one of the things you might have to deal with is singularities. And in fact, don't quit on me. Right there when it was so. Yeah. That wasn't planned. So in fact, if you're dealing with black holes, we know that black holes have a singularity in there. So what do you do when you try to deal with a singularity? Here at a singularity, the theory breaks. And numerically, you're going to have all sorts of nightmares, just to put it in a mild way. So what do? So suppose you have a star that is collapsing, the star that formed the black hole, just to fix ideas. So something that we know and that we use to call it black hole is that there is an event horizon here that forms. And an observer outside of this region can never see anything that is inside. So the main idea of dealing with singularities nowadays is to excise the singularity, it sounds very simple. It says, well, you were chugging along here nicely, with your simulation, at some point your event horizon form. And since the observer here doesn't know what's going on inside, just cut it out. That will let you leave, because here there's a singularity where everything is going to hell. Just cut it short there, and that would be a way to get away with murder. That actually, this was an idea suggested by Bill Unruh like almost 10 years ago, which works assuming you do the right thing, because mathematically the equations might not work as nice as the physics, as the intuition we have about the physics. So here, what we did is introduce another boundary. And I already said that the boundary treatment was complicated. If we put another one, it might be worse. Because in the other one, at least I could say I could push it further and further out, and that eventually will stop bothering me. But this one is right there. What do we do with it? The thing is, if you choose it carefully, say this is where you're terminating your evolution, this is your inner boundary. If you are far from the event horizon, then the domain of dependence of a point here is just a nice triangle looking back. But the domain of dependence of this guy here is actually still away from singularity, which is quite convenient, because now it means that you can update the solution there with information that you already had. And so you don't need the boundary condition. The boundary conditions are, the boundary values are provided by the evolution itself. That has two concepts. I mean, you can use this assuming two things. One is that you actually have, this thing is an outflow boundary in a way. And two, that you have the right foliation. Actually, three things. Which I mean by that is, we were totally free to choose the slicing of the space-time. We could have, instead of having chosen this, we could have chosen a foliation that goes like that. So it slows down here. We're totally free to do that. And that never touches that. So in this case, we wouldn't have this problem, because we're not ever touching the singularity, we would be fine. The problem is that this dealing with this numerically is quite complicated. Of course, the alternative would have been the field theory thing, just renormalize if you have an infinity. We don't know what the infinity looks like to renormalize it. So we do the human nature thing is, when something bothers you, you just get rid of it. And the third thing that this constrains is which kind of surface you're choosing. Not any surface inside the black hole is going to be such that it's an outflow type. So we're also working on this is something that we have to worry about. The other thing is that, the last thing is that we don't know where the event horizon is. You need the evolution to know where the event horizon is. I mean, the event horizon, again, is that region of space-time that no observer can ever see from, say, an infinite distance. So you have to wait all the way till you actually finish the simulation to find out where it is. There is a way, there is this notion of trapped surfaces. Which basically is the following. You choose a closed surface, you take null rays coming out of it, and you, in the absence of a black hole or anything that actually produces a strong curvature, these null rays would continue diverging out. But if you now have a strong focusing power in it, instead of diverging, it will converge. And a trapped surface is exactly that. And there are theorems that tell you, under reasonable conditions, that a trapped surface would be inside the event horizon. And these things you can actually find at a given surface, because you are only interested in what happens with those null rays, where they diverge or converge. So on the fly, we look for trapped surfaces. And hopefully, at the end of the day, then you can reconstruct the event horizon. So before actually keep saying things, let me now show you a few examples of how things look like in an actual simulation. Let's see if this works. Let's see. Okay, oops. So this is a picture here of what this one of these detectors look like. This LIGO that is in Livingston. There's another one pretty much like it in Hanford, Washington, except that one has two detectors. This one has only one in here. And the running joke is that this one, well, has only one, but has alligators. And I used to laugh at that joke till actually I moved to Baton Rouge, and now it's not a laughing matter. And then there is another one. There is a planned one. There is a one that would be, this is called LISA, that would be in space following the Earth. Instead of just having 4 kilometer arms, this one will have 5, 10 to the 6 kilometers, and would follow the Earth. So the frequencies that these detectors can access are quite different from those. LIGO will basically see from 10 hertz to 1,000 hertz gravitational waves. LISA is about, I think, 10 to the minus 4 hertz to about 1 hertz. So in combination, they cover quite a broad range of frequencies. So the good old days, I don't know why I'm calling good, but the old days at least, this is what a binary simulation would look like. This was about 2 or 3 years ago. And basically, this is a component of the metric, one of the things you're evolving, versus time. It's a set equals zero cut, just for the sake of it. The holes have been excised. That's why you see a constant there, which in this plot, which is showing something else. This bluish region inside is the thing that has been excised from the simulation, has been set to zero, and that's why it looks like that. This semi-transparent region is where this apparent horizon, this trap surface is. So you basically found where it was. You got a little bit in just to give you some room for numerical things. And excise all everything inside. So the boundaries here were about 10 m. If you're thinking that a black hole, a regular solar mass black hole, would have a radius of about 1 kilometer or so, or 2 or 3 kilometers, then we're putting the outer boundary here at about 30 kilometers. That would be like an Oxnard or something that I, when I drove this way, I didn't see one. So that was one of the problems. The boundaries were too close, and you see what I mean by pi boundary conditions. As these evolve, they merge. There is a single one there, but then you see all this garbage coming from the outer boundary. So let me just play it again. So this is another one that maybe you'll see the same thing. So these two guys are going to come together. They're going to merge, form a single one, and you also see the boundary and the tricks at the boundary. Here you see this garbage coming in, and it's kind of being sponged out. There is a filter there that tries to keep them in place. But then again, this is cheating. When you don't know, when you can't do better, you try to be creative. So that's what it looked like. Let me just show you another example. This is of a simulation carried out by the group at the Albert Einstein Institute in Germany, which basically is pretty much the same. Here, the black holes are not being excised, but the foliation is being chosen so that, in this example that I mentioned, where you have the black hole like that, the foliation is being chosen so that it bends and it never touches the singularity. We know that this eventually will have problems, but basically the main point there was to see if the infrastructure would hold two holes together that would merge. And so here, initially they start with two holes, by judging these trap surfaces that then eventually come together and form a single one. And this color map shows what gravitational waves would look like if you were really far out. It's a pretty fancy movie. Here's another one here as well. Same thing. So you see at the end there is, oops, cannot see. Not in this one. Let me try the other one. So these little blobs there, they're greenish. Those are the trap surfaces around each other one. And then at a little bit later time, you see a single one. So there is a single trap surface. And it says that at least at that stage, there is a single event horizon, a single black hole. Doesn't mean that initially there wasn't a black hole. Maybe there was, except that the simulation wasn't carried out such, far enough to the future that then the black holes were reconstructed.
Exactly,
is being modeled. Is that like Psi-4? Yeah, that's Psi-4. That's what I said. I mean, it has at least a feeling of gravitational waves, but it's not yet, as you're not far enough. Let me now show you a different one. This is a simulation of actually two neutron stars. And it's an animated GIF, so it doesn't really look nice. But it initially started with two equal neutron stars that go around each other, they merge, form a single one. At the end, you're going to see a black blob, and actually, there should be a small, doesn't show. But at the end, there is a small circle. That's when they find the trap surface, and the simulation just breaks there because they don't have an excision. They're not exciting the singularity, so they just hit the singularity basically. This is for two equal mass neutron stars. This is for two stars that are not exactly equal. One is much more compact than the other one. And you can see that one gets a lot more disrupted, and that the center actually lies basically where one of the stars is. So here. So this would be the analogous. In this case, the simulations of neutron stars, so I'm showing, and I talk mostly about black hole, the simulations about neutron star have the complexity that now you have to deal with the shock, with the fluids and all the soup that comes with the fluid, but they have a little bit better time because initially the fields are a bit weaker by a factor of square. So they are 25 times weaker in a way. So now basically everyone scaled down. Well, the guys doing the neutron star simulations are doing much better, so they are chugging. They're still working on the binary black hole, or the binary neutron star simulations. Basically, everyone else that was doing binary black holes scaled down, went back to basics, go back to a single black holes and even less than that, and try to study the fields there, try to study simulations, and try to see how new techniques or things that have been developed in the recent past, how they help. So here is a simulation where basically it's just even worse than a black hole simulation because it's a toy field, a scatter field propagating on the fixed background of black hole. So this is a Schwarzschild black hole that is sitting around here. The little square there is the excision of the singularity that's actually 3 points away. And it has to be so small such that you ensure these outflow conditions on the boundary. If you actually chose them a little bit bigger, given this resolution, you would have violated that condition. So this is a simulation just to show you. Again, you see similar things to what you saw before, but it actually looks a lot nicer. The boundaries do not reflect stuff widely back, and the simulations are coming quite nicely. If we were so lucky that these simulations could carry over to the black hole case, then things would be in pretty good shape, but we're not there yet. We're working on that. Let's see. Let me just show you another one. I couldn't embed it here, but this is the group at Caltech and Cornell. We basically have the same kind of simulation when we get it, except that now this black hole is spinning, and you'll see the dragging of the field around the black hole because the black hole inside is actually spinning. And these white lines that are there is because there is a domain decomposition in the way you implement the equation. So the equation, these patches are independently evolved, and then they are matched appropriately at the interfaces. And you see the effect of the spin there. So again, this looks quite nice and in much better shape than what we used to have in the past.
How long does that run?
This runs, have no problem. They can run for as long as one. But again, this as far as the field is concerned, it's a linear field. The background is given, but with the old ways, you wouldn't have gotten this nicer result. Let me now, just to give you an example, because it's a nice little problem. This is a problem in 2D, actually. It's not 3D. It's not even four dimensions. It's not classical GR. This is general relativity. It's being solved in a higher dimensional space-time, five dimensions. And because of symmetries, it actually scales down to a 2 plus 1 problem, where you so each point here is actually a sphere, and it has spherical symmetry. But you have radial direction in this in this direction and this extra dimension. So this is GR in 5D. And this is a problem of trying to understand the stability of higher dimensional analog of a black hole, which is, in this particular case, a black string. There was a paper like 10 years ago that said that if you kick the black string, as opposed to the black hole, that if you kick it in 4D, it relaxes again, it sheds away energy and basically relaxes back to a spherical black hole. We didn't really know what happens here. So Gary proved 2 years ago or a year ago that this the conjecture was that if you kick it and it's above some critical length, this black string would bifurcate, and you'll see why in a second. But he proves that it couldn't bifurcate in a finite time. It would have to take an infinite time. So basically, we actually went in and did the simulations to see what the dynamics of the system is. So let me show. This is basically the apparent horizon, or these trap surfaces, for the outermost trap surface, for a case where the extra dimension is not long enough to be unstable. So if you kick that one, it actually just wobbles for a little bit and slowly decays back to another black string. But if you now, instead of that one, try it at an above critical case, and you kick it, it's going to oscillate for a while, and then there's a mode that takes over that initially grows exponentially and makes this guy shrink by a lot. So if we started at something that had initial radius of 2, it went all the way down to 0.3. And it grew in the extra dimension. So even in this case, which is a two-dimensional problem, which where we had a lot more computational resources at our disposal, this run takes several days. And it's running on 120 processors. So this is just to set the tone of how difficult these things are. Even in 2D, where you do have enough computational resources, lots of things have to be taken care of. In particular, this simulation terminates there. It crashes because the coordinates are not nicely adapted to this geometry of the problem at the very end, because it's just elongated so much in this direction and it shrunk so much in this one that you lose resolution by a lot. And this here is just an example of how, even at very late times, this is a trap surface, but you want to see where the event horizon actually was doing that. So what you do is, the event horizon is an attractor for null surfaces. So if you now have this event horizon here, which you don't really know where it is, you have this as your inner boundary, this was the trap surfaces. So that basically what you can do is start surfaces around here that are null and trace them back in the past. Surfaces are here that are null and you trace them back in the past. And because the event horizon is an attractor, they should meet together. And at least when they meet, you can say that's a good approximation to the event horizon. So this is that exercise, but run now forward in the future. So you'll see basically two surfaces that start here. They come down together for quite a long time. And then one goes, but the one that was up a tiny bit inside goes towards the singularity. The other one goes towards infinity. So just an example of something else that we have to do in the simulations to try to get the physics out. So at the end, you saw one goes away and the other one just hits in. So I don't know. Let me just turn this. That's a cheap way. So I'm not sure how much of this info was actually useful. I thought I was able to convey some of the problems that we're dealing with, some of the things that we're thinking about, and the main problem that we have in our hands. Why is it that we're working in it? If LIGO weren't measuring already, lots of these things would be done a lot more slower. We would probably all be doing 2D, or mostly. But LIGO is measuring. We have to give the information to them as soon as we can. And so these are more or less the problems we're dealing with. Thank you.